following lecture on religion and science was given at Saudi Telecom on the 23rd of January 1992. أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم إنما يخشى الله من عباده العلماء. Those who truly fear Allah among His servants are those with knowledge. Chapter 35, verse 28 of the Quran. Alhamdulillahi Rabbil Alameen, wa salatu wa salam ala Rasulil Kareem, wa ala alihi wa sahbihi, wa man istanna bi sunnati ila yawmiddin. All praise due to Allah, and may Allah's peace and blessings be on His last Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, and on all those who follow the path of righteousness until the last day. The topic, religion and science, is one which has its roots in European history, wherein a conflict developed between the Christian Church and scientific inquiry. That conflict has created in the Western scientific mind a generally negative attitude towards institutionalized religion. The attitude that people hold, which is a product of history, is that science is based on facts and religion is based on blind faith. Therefore, science is something which we can rely on because it can be proven, it's based on facts. And religion is something which is in some ways irrational, science being rational because it's based on facts, we can reason with it, we can understand it. Whereas religion is looked at as something irrational. This is the general attitude which we find prevalent in the world today. Now this concept, this understanding, as I said, is a product of history. It is not something which was always held. These are not beliefs which were always held. These are a product of certain developments which took place, particularly in Europe, where modern science as we know it evolved out of. And if we go back actually to the history to look at the origin of these sciences, of science in general, we'll find in fact that its origin was not so much in the facts and the rational understanding of these facts as we would be led to believe today. If we take the general definition of science, and this is one I'm quoting from Merit's Student Encyclopedia, simplified version, science is the sum of human knowledge of the universe. This definition, of course, includes everything. This includes religion, because religion provides certain knowledge about the universe, as well as what we understand to be science in general, includes philosophy, a variety of different fields. Any field of knowledge which pertains in any way, shape or form to the universe would then be classified as science in this general definition. However, the definition goes on to say it deals with facts. And here is where the scientists say, well, here's the difference now between science and religion, philosophy, etc. Science deals with facts. Everybody else is dealing with ideas, which may be a product of human experience, human reflection. However, that definition doesn't stop there. It says it deals with facts and with the relationships between them. See, here we now step into another field. First, they said that science deals with facts. no problem. These facts is things that we observe, things which are measurable, etc. But then it goes on to talk about the relations between them, because it's not just the observation of these facts, but a relation is developed between them. An explanation is given to these facts. These facts are strung together to form some story, some picture, which is explained. Now comes philosophy. Because these facts, as in all cases, facts by themselves do not tell us anything. It is when you put ideas to those facts, when you string the facts in a particular form, and then you draw that relationship between that, the facts can now tell us something. And when you go to make that relationship, that the ideas that you're going to put there, this now is a reflection of your philosophy. So what this is in fact telling us is that science is based on philosophy. It is in fact based on philosophy. Religion is based, we could say, on a philosophy, on an understanding, on an explanation. But it also is based on certain facts. There are certain facts which it strings together, and with a philosophy it produces an understanding of the universe. Science has certain facts which it strings together, maybe the same facts. And with its understanding, its philosophy, it gives us another picture of the universe. What has happened is that in history, in relationship to Christianity, these pictures have conflicted. And because of this conflict, modern society has looked at religion as being irrational, unprovable, and chosen science as its new religion. Because this is what is in fact has happened. Science in modern times has become the religion of modern man. It explains or seeks to explain why man exists, how he exists, how he came to where he is coming, where is he headed. All these questions, when you look into the scientists who are, you know, delving into the secrets of the universe, splitting the subatomic particles, etc. What are they looking for? They'll tell you, we're looking for the building blocks of nature, the origin, to be able to create, to understand ultimately. They believe that by asking the right questions, doing the right experiments, you will ultimately be able to understand everything. Man, in fact, is the God of this world. And he, this is the philosophy, is capable of not only understanding, but creating. When we look in the past, and the definition of science comes from the Latin scientia, which means knowledge. When you look in the very past to what Western science considers to be the origin of science, we see a period of time in around the 7th to the 5th century before the time of Christ in Greece, where science, or I should say at this point it was philosophy, was geared primarily to determining the basic elements of the universe. Philosophy of that time period in Greece was geared to determining the basic elements of the universe. They were asking the same questions
that the scientists today are asking. But in that time, initially, it was considered philosophy, straight philosophy. Now it's called science. In that period, no differentiation was made between science and philosophy. Later, science came to be regarded as a component part of philosophy, and finally, as a set of disciplines altogether separate from philosophy. So we see that science and the concept of science went through a period of evolutionary change. It changed. The same questions asked by science today was asked by the originators of science in their philosophies of the past. And the leading figures, people like Plato and Aristotle, who for Western science, you know, represents the major figures, they considered that it was more noble and dignified to seek answers by reasoning rather than by experiment. They felt that experimentation is for the ignorant, those who had to go and to play with matter, etc. Those who were the true scholars, the higher minds, they understood things from their reasoning. They looked at the universe around them, and using their minds and their logic and the reason, they were able to draw conclusions, establish principles and laws governing what existed around them. As such, you find that certain concepts developed from that time. For example, that if you drop a heavy ball and a light ball at the same time, you got a heavy ball in your hand, you know, like a cannonball, and you have a marble, small ball, you drop the two of them, the heavy ball will hit the ground before the small ball. This is what was reasoned. It looked logical. This was bigger, it was heavier, it should hit the ground before the other one, which was smaller and lighter. This was a principle proclaimed way back before the time of Christ, and which was only experimentally checked around the 15th century, when they finally got around to checking this idea, and they did drop the heavy ball and the light ball, they found that both of them hit the ground at the same time. And this is after many centuries had passed, you know, where people had accepted this idea of what appeared to be logical and reasonable. But as I said, this was the beginnings of science in philosophy. And these beginnings actually never changed. The philosophy has remained till today. It has been modified. However, the basis of modern science today is in philosophy. What we found as we went on with the history of Western science, we found that after the time of the Greeks, in the early hundreds, 200s, after the time of Jesus, we found that the Roman Empire took over. It brought the Greeks under their control, and with it most of this area, the Mediterranean area. And the Romans were not as much into science, into reasoning, etc. They were more concerned with administration. So we find that scientific inquiry sort of went on a decline during this period. And something happened. With the spread of Christianity, we find that around the 4th century, in this period, that the concept of the Trinity was adopted by the Holy Roman Emperor at the time, Constantine, and this was imposed on the rest of the Christian world. This is in the 4th century. They had a council of Nicaea in 325 and a series of other councils in which this Trinitarian concept was introduced into Christianity. Prior to that, the majority of Christians were Unitarians. They believed that God was one. Not three in one, but just one. And what we find is that after this period of the introduction of the concept of Trinity, we find Europe entering, with the beginning of the 6th, 5th, 6th century, entering into what came to be known as the Dark Ages. From the 6th century all the way up to the 11th century is referred to in European history as the Dark Ages. This is the age, this is the period of time when knowledge reached its lowest ebb. Most of the literature, the writings, the scientific theories of the Greeks, etc., was mostly forgotten. A few monks in monasteries maintained some of this knowledge, but it was used basically to serve the purpose of the church. The church scholars would take some of the theories of the past, which seemed to fit or provide some kind of room for the development of the new Christian philosophy, and they had a tight rein on any kind of scientific inquiry. They established what was to be the understanding of the world, and they wanted no competition. During this period, we find Islam was established in the Middle East, the 7th, 8th centuries, and from there it spread over North Africa into Palestine and into Spain, into Southern Europe. And this is a time now when the sciences flourished. The sciences of the Greeks were translated into Arabic, and Arabic became the language of science. What was translated was not merely translated and just kept and read, but was developed upon. Science which was in Persia, in India, was brought over, combined, and Muslim scientists worked with this and developed science to a very high level, establishing universities in the region of Palestine and Baghdad and Spain, North Africa, Morocco, etc. And during this period, we find the Crusades beginning. And what happened is that towards the end of this period, around the 12th century, we find a renaissance beginning in Europe. From European scientists, scholars, going to Spain, taking information back from Palestine, from the Crusades, we find a revival of knowledge in Europe. And it was during this period that, you know, some of the great philosopher scientists like St. Thomas Aquinas and Roger Bacon, etc., you know, developed the theories and concepts which became the basis for modern philosophy and science. However, after an initial spurt, we find that the church trying to rein things back in, to get it back under control. And following the bubonic plagues in Europe, what was known as the Black Plague, a lot of people died, the church gained sway over the situation. Scientists really couldn't explain what was happening. People turned back to depend on religion, and the church established itself again firmly. All people, all scientists or scholars who were proposing ideas which were contrary to what the church had established from way back in the Dark Ages and prior, were now put under scrutiny. Inquisition courts were set up, and those who were found to hold ideas contrary were executed. For example, one Giordano Bruno, who was executed for heresy in 1600s because he stated that the universe was infinite and the earth only a small body in it. We know of Copernicus, who had published a sun-centered theory about the solar system, about the universe. Prior to this, it was held that the earth was the center, you know, according to the Greek philosophers, which the church adopted. The earth was the center of the universe. Everything else revolved around the earth. You know, man was the most important being in this universe. So that the earth-centered concept was attractive to the early Christian church. So now when Copernicus, from his observations, etc., he was an astronomer, determined that in fact the sun was the center and the earth revolved around it, he himself was so afraid for his life, he did not publish this until the year that he died. He published his thesis on the sun-centered theory of the solar system the year that he died. He kept quiet. He had worked it out many years before. You know, in fact, he had finished his work in 1529, but he didn't publish it until 1543, you know, when he died. This is for fear of what was going to happen to him from the clergy. Galileo, he carried on Copernicus' ideas. He accepted them and tried to promote them. And the church called him up, tried him, told him at first, because, you know, he was a favorite son of Italy, they told him at first just to cool down, don't promote this theory, you know, be quiet, we don't want, you know, any problems. But he insisted, and after his insistence, you know, when he did do some writings which supported Copernicus' theories, he was himself called up, tried, convicted of teaching false doctrines, and compelled to renounce the Copernican theory, and was imprisoned. Later was changed to house arrest, where he died. But he kept on writing in any case, but this is what was happening to the scholars there in Europe. However, the contact which had been made with Muslims in Spain, in Palestine, etc., continued to bear fruit, and combined with a Reformation movement which developed in Europe, wherein we had people like Calvin and Martin Luther challenging the Roman Catholic Church. And Martin Luther's challenge began when he had taken a pilgrimage to Rome to go to the spiritual center to renew his spiritual feelings, to get further spiritual understanding. When he came to Rome and he found the Pope, you know, was sitting on a throne like a temporal king, he had a crown of gold which was so heavy he couldn't even put on his head. It had to be strung up from the ceiling by, you know, by wires. You know, he was shocked. Here he was sitting there in golden robes with, you know, with staffs and scepters, etc., just like a temporal king. Martin Luther returned from Rome and condemned what he saw as corruption. Himself and Calvin and the others started the Reformation movement, which broke away from Roman Catholicism and developed what is now known as the Protestant movement or Protestantism. Besides this, we had scientists who took advantage of this period of breakup, this period of rejection of the Roman Catholic Church, and started to delve into questions concerning religion in general. And what we found born out of this period, along with Protestantism, is atheism as a theory, as a reasoned principle. It produced later the Marxist dialectical materialism, which is often called scientific socialism, wherein human history is reduced to an economic struggle between the haves and the have-nots, and all social systems become an expression of the classes, religion being a tool used by the ruling class to maintain the status quo, and God a fictitious friend of the rich who predestined their rule over the poor. That was the sum total of what religion represented. On the other hand, you had other body of scientists who developed what is known as the Darwinian theory, wherein human existence is determined to be the result of natural forces. There was no need to go to look into the supernatural to explain man's existence, why he's here, where he's going, why he's what he is, etc., etc. Natural selection or survival of the fittest becoming the principle which determines man's existence and where he's headed. Now, we have, when we look into this period, some reasons which have led the scientists of this period to come to these type of conclusions. One of them, I feel, is fundamentally based in the Trinitarian concept. The concept of the Trinity, wherein man is required to accept that God is one, and at the same time, He is three. The facts tell us that 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 3. But religion, from the 4th century onward in Europe, taught that 1 plus 1 plus 1 equals 1 in relationship to God. So this is something which is inexplicable. It is something which the church puts under the heading of a divine secret. You cannot understand it. No matter what explanations you try to give, it cannot be explained. So it is something which goes against the nature which God created man in, wherein He analyzes things logically. So there is something that these scientists, something which is eating away at them, which doesn't seem logical to them, which they cannot express. This is why you found people like, for example, Newton, Isaac Newton. He rejected the Trinitarian concept. But he didn't disbelieve in God. It's not all of the scientists took this path. You know, actually it was really a minority among the scientists, but they tended to be the most vocal. Even today, there's a general understanding that we have that, you know, say scientists in America are atheists. They don't believe in God. This is not really true. Polls which are taken of the majority of scientists in America is that some 80% of them believe in God. They may not accept traditional religion or the traditional understanding of God in terms of God becoming man, etc., etc., of Christianity, but they believe in God. There's only a 15 to 20% who actually disbelieve in God. However, this 10 or 15% are very vocal. You know, they're very, you know, enthusiastic in promoting their ideas. So if one were to read or to watch the television or etc. in America, you have people like Carl Sagan, you know, who, you know, is one of the best, explainers of scientific theory in layman's terms. You know, he's able to take that complex ideas of astronomy and biology and biochemistry and put it in very simple, easily understood words. But this man is a confirmed atheist, and he gets a lot of television time. So if one were to watch television in America, scientific type things, you would assume that, geez, you know, all these people really don't believe in God. But he is just one among a few who are actually, as I said, very vocal in their explanations. People, as I said, like Newton, for example, Isaac Newton, he believed in one God. And he provided, you know, what came to be the unifying theory of science of that period of time. But he relied on the belief in the existence of God. And he would discuss and argue with some of his atheistic friends and prove to them through, you know, reason and logic that God does exist. However, the Trinitarian God of Christianity, he did not accept. So, when we look at this process, and then we go over to now look at Islam and science, we see that there is obviously a difference between the two from the very root. One, the Islamic concept of God is that God is a unity. One, indivisible, having no parts. God is one, in the purest sense. This concept was a concept which was arrived at by the Greeks, the same Greeks, Plato and Aristotle. They used reasoning to come to this conclusion. Without revelation available to them, they used pure logic and reasoning to come to the conclusion that there was one God, only. So, if we use, as we said, we use the rational mind, without the influence of theories, etc., it will, arguing logically, come to the conclusion of the existence of one God. So for Islam, there is no problem here. There is no fundamental contradiction, you know, irrationality in its concept of God. So there is no conflict in the base between what we could say philosophical science, because really we don't, as we said, science is not purely facts, there is a philosophy there, which involves reasoning, etc. This philosophical science, when it reasons using the facts, it will come to that same conclusion. The majority of the scholars, scientific scholars, hold this, and that was, as I said, the conclusions arrived at by the origins of what is known as Western science, the Greek philosophers. Furthermore, we find, as our young brother read, he read from the first verses which were revealed of the Quran, from a chapter known as Al-Alaq, or the leech-like clot, blood, in reference to the development of man within the womb of the woman. It begins, Iqra, read. This was the first commandment given to the Prophet Muhammad, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon him. Read, Iqra, bismi rabbika alladhi khalaq. Read in the name of He who created. It goes on to say, عَلَّمَ الْإِنسَانَ مَا لَمْ يَعْلَمْ, that Allah taught man what he didn't know. And that Allah taught man to write, not only to read, but to write. This is the beginnings of the revelation. Knowledge is there. We find in the Quran, when God commands concerning belief, He says, اعلموا أنه لا إله إلا الله. No, you should have knowledge that there is no God but Allah. Knowledge precedes faith. In the Islamic system, knowledge precedes faith. We are required to know who God is before we can worship Him. Because if you don't know who God is, then you can end up with the sincerest of desires worshipping a tree, or a stone, or the stars, or animal, or man. No one can question the sincerity of your worship, but because it was not based on knowledge, you are worshipping other than God, thinking that in fact you are worshipping God. And this is what has happened to much of mankind. So, knowledge is something, and we said that science was the totality of man's knowledge of the universe. Knowledge is something which we look at as being revealed by God to man for the service of man. Allah says in the Quran that when He created Adam, He taught him the names of everything. He gave him knowledge, the ability to classify, to identify the things around him. This is what makes man, part of what makes man superior to the animals. The animals may deal with their environment, but they're not able to classify it and utilize it and to build on the knowledge that they have previously. Animals, what they have is what is natural to them, and they just utilize it without reflection or anything. But man's ability to classify and identify, this allows him an opportunity to reflect on the relationships between them, to build on this knowledge and to advance with every generation. You know, like an otter, for example, if you observe an otter is a sea animal found in North America, which will build homes, it will tear, bite, chew down trees and gather the pieces of the trees and make homes, underwater homes, this type of thing, very complex. But the otter cannot build on that knowledge. If you take the otter out of that environment and you put him on the desert, he's finished. You put him in an environment that doesn't have water for him to build these type of homes, he can't survive. He's not able to transfer that knowledge he has into another environment. Whereas man, he's able. He knows how to build a home in the desert. He can transfer that knowledge, adapt it, and build it in the jungle. And he can build it in the North Pole. He's able to apply his knowledge. We believe this is from God. So therefore, in Islam, there is no contradiction between knowledge in the true sense and the teachings of Islam. What you find when you look into the Quran itself, a variety of indications, pointers to science, to knowledge of the universe. God speaks of a variety of different processes which only in our recent times we have been able to identify. The process of the formation of milk in the cow, the development of the embryo in the womb of the mother. It's identified and described in such details that one of the leading embryologists, Dr. Moore from Canada, he revised his book on embryology, including, because prior to this he had mentioned when he was looking at the history of embryology, he had given all the different theories that were in Europe, you know, which are a lot of wild stuff, and showed that the, you know, it wasn't until after the discovery of the microscope, etc., etc., that, you know, in the 19th century, 20th century, that the correct concept of the development of the embryo was understood. Finally, he came across, he was shown, he was invited to a conference, and the verses of the Quran concerning the development of the embryo were given to him to analyze, and to his surprise he found a description which matched modern science's understanding so closely that he amended his book, his textbook, putting in a section there that, surprisingly enough, way back in the 14th century, in the 8th century, you know, 1400 years ago, this description did exist of the development of the embryo at a time when there were no microscopes. There was no way, really, that man could possibly describe this evolution or this development of the embryo. He left it at that. One would question, well, there are some other steps that should be taken if this is what you found. As a matter of fact, one embryologist from Thailand who attended the same conference, after he saw those facts, he declared that he was a Muslim. That was enough for him, you know, because this was something obviously which could not have been the product of a man. And when you go through the Quran, and there, as I said, there are a number of references to theories and facts which modern science have now accepted as being facts as a whole, which were way beyond their time, which were not understood in that period of time. Of course, some people may say, well, if we go back to the ancient philosophers of Greece, etc., we find some of them proposing concepts which have now become accepted scientific facts. True, However, at the same time that these scientists proposed some ideas which turned out to be fact today, they also made some colossal blunders. They made some statements, as I told you, about the heavy ball and the light ball. There are many others which are really, really outlandish, which modern science, you know, rejects totally. So though they may have a few instances of correct predictions, they had many instances of misunderstandings. Whereas when we go through the Quran, we find that all of the references to scientific or natural phenomena match what is known by scientific facts. It is consistent. And this is not the normal pattern, as I said, of people who prophesy or, you know, just speculate, we should say. Prophesy in the secular sense. I don't mean in the religious sense. Those who speculate, they're not going to be consistently correct. They'll be correct sometimes, but many times they will be incorrect. So we find here the Quran speaking about these various natural phenomena. We find it calling man to knowledge, calling man to learn, to understand that this knowledge came from God and that it is to be used for the benefit of man. As such, science found a home in the Muslim civilization. As I mentioned, it took the books of Greece and of India, Persia, etc., translated these books, developed the sciences, and scientists were held in esteem. In the Muslim world, scientists were held in esteem. They were not afraid of being put before inquisition courts or executed for heretical statements, etc. No. This was not the case. So we find historically science has a very strong established basis within the bounds, within the fold of Islam. There has been no struggle between science and Islam. However, to be realistic, we know that there have been, in the past, theories proposed by Muslim scientists which have been proven wrong in these times. So it doesn't mean that every theory produced by Muslim scientists was correct. And we also have had, in not too distant past, you know, some religious scholars who have made statements, for example, that the earth is flat, you know, which contradicts what we know to be modern science. However, these statements of individuals are not considered to be Islam per se. These are just reflections of individuals. These are not considered to be, you know, Islamic law. So now we have a challenge between science and Islam. No. The individual, for example, who said the earth was flat, sufficient people sat with him, brought him enough evidence, and he backed off it and accepted that the earth was round. Actually, you know, over 1,000 years before that, maybe about 800 years before that, one of the Muslim geographers, Idrisi, he proposed that the earth was round, a Muslim geographer. And he laid down his reasoning, his arguments, etc., based on the facts that he observed from traveling, seeing how land approaches when you're, you know, when you're in the sea, when you're approaching the shoreline, the land seems to increase what you see of it. If the earth were flat, you know, you would see the land even from a distance. It would just appear, you know, more clear as you got closer. But what he found was that the land was invisible at a distance and became more and more visible, showing more and more as he came towards it, which seemed to imply that the earth was in fact round, and so therefore as you're coming over the horizon, the thing becomes visible. This was his line of reasoning. And also there are verses in the Quran which were used to support this concept. So what we find here is that though we may find Muslims, scholars or scientists, making statements at different points in history which may contradict what we now know to be scientific fact, these do not in and of themselves represent a conflict between religion and science. These were merely opinions and Muslims as a whole reject those opinions when the evidence comes to the contrary. We have no problem, science, Islam has no problem in dealing with what we may classify as scientific fact. But as I said, science within the Islamic scope is looked at as being something given by God to man to serve man. So, historically, science within the Muslim world has been used to improve the quality of life of man. Whereas what happened as the process of science developed in Europe and in the West is that science, once it divorced itself from religion, religion became separate, science was now separate. The moral values of religion were also removed. So science was no longer, had no moralistic guidelines. It became now the tool of the state or the capitalists, those who are in control of the economy. On a state level, it could be used to justify dropping the atomic bomb, you know, on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, obliterating, you know, thousands of lives. Because morality is taken out of here. This is an issue of survival now, survival of the fittest. Darwin's theory comes back into play. On the economic frame, you have so many scientists who will develop new improvements for products, but the big companies will stop the development of these improvements until it is convenient to them. Many of the new developments which are put in the motor car today to improve gas, you know, usage, etc., these were developed 20, 30 years ago. But the oil companies, the car producers, they hid these facts from the general public. They did not implement them because it would affect their profits at that time. So when they had their maximum profits out of using the old gas guzzlers, and people are now crying for something else, well, they introduced these new developments. But they were old. So we find science, you know, in the West, generally speaking, not serving the interest of man, but serving the interests of certain elements. You find people spending billions of dollars to go to the moon, to explore Mars. You know, America is spending billions of dollars to go to the moon and explore Mars. And at the same time, it has nearly a million people living in the streets, homeless. You know, when we think of people who live and die in the streets, we think of Calcutta. You know, this is what comes to my mind, is, you know, Ronak going in the West. This is what comes to my mind, Calcutta, India. This is where people live and die in the streets. But no, in America, close to a million people are there, living in the streets without home, dying when the winter comes suddenly, getting frozen to death. People dying of malnutrition. This exists in America.